sank her in line. I said, fish, 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 fishing. Boy, I'm going fishing just to ease my mind.
There it is, there it is, there it is. Ah, the number one reason. Check it out, go fishing. I gotta tell you, boys and girls, I saw something this morning made, you know, in the fishing industry, there's a lot of indicators on what's going on. Fish and Frank here, by the way, Robert and Cher across from me, and RJ in command and control. But I was at the store, and one of the reps groups companies was in, and, you know, they're selling me all this stuff, and I'm spending a bunch of money, and new guy with them, so I'm showing him around a little bit. We go out the back door of the store, and there's like three bicycles and kids rigging their rods, getting ready to go fishing. And that is one of the best indicators. Over the years, we've had so many bicycle brigades and kids that pile in on their bicycles, and they come up to the counter and they got change, and you know, they dump this pile of change, and is this enough to get shrimp? Yeah, 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 okay. So, you know, they get their shrimp or their frozen bait or whatever it is, and we count through the change and get our 87 cents for whatever the bait is. You know, it's just, but it's one of the best indicators that, you know, Port Charlotte's still a pretty cool place.
Gives you a warm and fuzzy feeling, too.
It was kind of neat because the guy I was with, he said, I've never seen bicycles like that at the bait shop. I said, are you kidding? That's like the best thing ever, you know. When you've got the kids covered up and some of them sneak away because they're not supposed to ride on this road or that road and sneak their way to the store. Others, their parents let them come in. And I can't tell you how many times the very first place a kid ever went into on their own was to come in and get shrimp. You look down, here's some little kids standing there with a bait bucket, and they give you the money, and you help them count change and all that, and it's just kind of cool. It's, you know, one of the weird things about working at Fish and Frank's.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool.
I mean, it almost makes the day worthwhile, huh?
It totally makes the day worthwhile.
And it's also seeing that kids are coming up, and they're still dealing with nature. They didn't come in with smartphones, playing games on the smartphone, or
no,
sitting at home doing Xbox. They were out buying, bicycling, buying shrimp, going fishing.
Yeah,
there's still hope for humanity.
It makes you feel good, and it's one of the cool things about that store is how many of the kids just kind of hang out, and you know, we built that new back deck, and we got the big mural and all that, and
right.
They're sitting there, and, you know, that little bench Chuck made, and, you know, doing all their rigging and everything, getting everything going. I was just kind of excited to see it.
Right.
If you have questions for us, 941-286-6460. And I did correct the numbers on the website, so it's correct everywhere. 941-286-6460. You can text message us questions. I don't have the phone part of that on right now, but the text part is working. So, anyway, we're working on all that kind of stuff, getting that together. So, 941-268-6460 if you got questions. We had a survey going on. We're going back to Luigi's, doing seminars at Luigi's. And so far, it's like 9-1. People want us to reserve seats, so they show up and they actually have a seat. I was really hoping they didn't want reserve seating because it's a lot of extra work. It's a lot more problems. And what we're going to be doing is if you want to sign up, the first of each month, you'll be able to sign up and reserve seats for Luigi's meeting, dinner and a fishing show, so to speak. People like going there, I think, to get their fishing information because the food is good, the atmosphere is great, you know, they just kind of relax, have a good time.
Oh, absolutely.
And we've got dates booked at Luigi's all the way through December, so starting in May and all the way through December. But it looks like we're going to keep the reserve seats. So I'll keep the questionnaire going on for a while. You text your yes or no answer to 941-268-6460. Or you can email frank@fishandfranks.com. Remember, no G in fishing. It's fishing. It's southern. And speaking of fishing, Spanish mackerel still coming around?
Yeah, they're actually doing a little bit better on them this past few days. Still, the majority of them are from Cape Hayes out through Boca Grande Pass and even out to 10 miles. But we are starting to see a few more stragglers in the upper harbor from, say, marker 2 out through the 20-foot holes. Biggest thing is you got to look for some birds working, look for some of the little bit of bait that's out there in the middle holes, and you'll also see some of these fish are skyrocketing. And you're not catching a lot of numbers, but they're pretty good quality fish in the upper part of the harbor.
So you think there's any kings mixed in? We've had that over the years.
Yeah. This week's been weird with the kings. I haven't heard anything because I've had several people in the last couple days asking me about the king mackerel, and I haven't gotten a single report in about 5 days on king mackerel.
So you think there are some mixed in with the schools and just misidentified as Spanish?
Oh, yeah, that's always very, very probable, especially on those little juvenile king mackerel because they do look so similar.
Because every few years we get a big bunch of king mackerel in Shaw Harbor. It's not common, but it's not rare. It's every once in a while.
Right.
And we usually find out about it because somebody actually is catching them and goes, wait a minute, that's a king. You know, they'll get a 24-inch, 30-inch, and they're looking at it, wait a minute, that's not a Spanish, that's actually a king.
Yeah.
So, not common, it's not rare to have that happen,
right.
But I would say the biggest thing on that is just, is somebody going to recognize which one it is?
Yeah.
Because we got Spanish, kings, we got Cyril, there's at least three different mackerel that come into Charlotte Harbor.
Correct.
King mackerel don't normally like to come up in the harbor, but when they're small, they'll start going along with a group of Spanish mackerel, following a bunch of other fish, and just kind of come in with them.
Yeah.
And as they get older, they tend to stay more in the Gulf. We don't get a lot of the bigger kings in there, unless we have super huge populations of glass minnows, anchovies, whatever you want to call them.
Right. You know, and you get those weird moments where it just happens, you know, a big straggler will move in. I mean, the biggest kingfish I've ever seen caught in the harbor was 47 inches. You know, and that was that one gentleman, over 10 years ago. It was his last bait of the day, and he was reeling it in when he was pulling the anchor, you know, and came in and showed it to us. But he caught that right at marker 1.
Yeah, it's just kind of amazing.
It does happen with the big ones.
Because there's no gate on Boca Grande Pass, the fish can come and go as they please. There's no rules. I swear to God, I saw whales in Charlotte Harbor one day.
Yeah?
Some small whales.
Well, we have the pygmy sperm whale here. And what's the other one?
A pilot whale?
Pilot whale.
Yeah.
There you go.
I've seen pilot whales off the jetty at Venice on numerous occasions.
Yeah. And
so they're definitely here in the area.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going through, and they were north of Boquilla, and I'm looking, I'm thinking, that's not dolphin, and then I'm thinking, that's not dolphin fins, and then I'm thinking shark, and they were humping over like a dolphin would, you know, that curling motion, not just coming up to the surface and traveling and going down. So it definitely wasn't a shark. They were acting differently.
Right.
They were acting more like dolphins. So
then, yeah, absolutely, probably is what you saw was definitely somewhere.
Remember when I thought I saw a sea monster and you had to correct me?
Sorry.
I'm sitting here thinking, we got a Loch Ness monster. I mean, this is, I literally thought, I had no idea what it could possibly be. This huge thing that looked like a serpent, dragon, you know, because when I saw it going through the water, I could see the back coming out. You know how you picture a Loch Ness monster?
Yeah.
Not the dinosaur one, but the kind of snake-looking one?
Yes.
And I'm thinking that. Then I'm hearing stories down by Marco, Fort Myers Beach, and, you know, these sea monster stories. And I'm thinking, man, we got the major sea monster thing going on here. There's something really weird. And Robert goes, oh, well, that's a
oarfish.
And I had no idea what an oarfish was. OAR, right?
Yes,
OAR, oarfish.
poor fish.
Yeah, I don't know if that's spelled. I don't think it's spelled that way. I might be wrong.
I don't know.
Either way,
they get up like 30 feet long.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, they come in by shore and along in the shallows and stuff, they'll actually hump through the water kind of like a serpent or a snake would or a dragon.
Right.
Well, they look like a cross between an eel and a fish.
Yeah.
An interesting animal. The reason they're called oarfish, and a little bit of trivia here for you, is a lot of the old fishing boats didn't have oars with paddles on the end of them. They look like just long poles, flat poles. And so they're shaped just like the oarfish is shaped. And that's what, like, the old Kurochs and other fishing boats use for propulsion. They look like long, flat planks.
And so,
it looks just like the oar that they used on those boats.
So the whole oar was flat rather than just the end.
Yeah, the whole oar was flat.
Okay.
There's another fish we have here that'll pop up once in a while, but it's much smaller, and it's called a lance fish. And it's very much serpentine-like.
Lance,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's I think they only top out at about 4 or 5 feet, if I remember right, versus 25 to 30 feet like the other one. But still really an unusual critter that we do have here.
All right, so if this oarfish is 25, 30 feet long,
uh-huh,
and I'm suspect it exists, I'm still going with the Charlotte Harbor monster theory.
Okay.
Yeah, I would think if you were in the water with one of those guys as it went by, you'd think monster
bite?
Too, yeah.
Does it eat?
It's a predator. It's got some pretty long, skinny fang-like teeth for gripping. It doesn't have it for
like a shark. It's
It's not made for cutting. It's actually made for penetrating and holding onto, similar to like a pyara or vampire fish. You know, it's just got real long.
So basically, it's going to grab you and hold you until you die.
Correct.
Does it constrict like a boa constrictor? Hold you and drown.
Just holds on
until it can swallow you.
Yep.
So
teeth very similar to a gar, but a lot longer.
All right. So how big around a diameter would one of these fish be? It's 30 feet long. Is it a foot around or 2 foot?
The biggest one that I've ever seen, like actual video footage of, to compare it to a human, was one that was in Mexico, swimming right along the beach. And it was, I think, 18 feet long or 19 feet long, something like that. And if I remember right, it was about 15 inches or so tall. So you're probably talking about 36 inches around, 38 inches around total. It's a very skinny fish, but you're talking 15 inches plus three or four thick. So, yeah.
Okay.
Pretty interesting.
So, the Charlotte Harbor monster theory still exists. We have monsters, sea creatures. It was a dragon. It wasn't an oarfish. I know this for a fact.
Okay.
All right. Speaking of big things, tarpon. It's probably the most prevalent fish in the harbor right now. Now, I think I was mistaken on something, and it's killing me to admit it. But
you okay?
Yeah, well, you know, I hate it, but I think there's a phenomenon I noticed that, and I think I'm wrong with it. When they all bunch up off Cape Hayes going north along the west side of the harbor, and they just massive group of them, and usually I would see them or get reports of them, and I just had a report of that from like Sunday, and I always thought that meant they were to scatter out through the harbor. And what I believe it actually means is because when they first move in, they kind of go all over the place. We get some in Boca Grande, and they're all over mixed in. But I think what that grouping is they're done scattering the harbor for a while, and okay, everybody, let's go do the boy meet girl thing in the pass, and let's go start spawning in the pass. They all get together there along Cape Hayes, north up. And I mean, just one after the other, thousands of them all stacked up. And because I heard that Sunday, Carl had seen them and was catching the heck out of them. And now, a few days later, they're all bunched up in Boca Grande Pass. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of those fish moved out of the harbor and out to the pass. So I think your theory is probably correct that they do kind of gather up in their little pre-party groups. Well, I mean, that's about the only way to describe it, I guess. I mean, they come
in from Mexico and Louisiana and Africa, and they come from all over the world to come back here to do the spawning and mating thing. And there's thousands of them all get together, hundreds and hundreds of them.
Right. Yeah, and I think them coming into the harbor is, one, there's a little bit of safety in numbers, one's reacquainting themselves, but also I think the diversity of forage foods that we have in the harbor, I think maybe they come in to maybe get themselves gorged.
If we could get the locals and the government to say no more commercial food shrimping in Charlotte Harbor, I think we would have more fish, more grouper, more snapper. There's so many... Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, all them, all close their shrimping down. And so all them come to Florida, all these boats from out of state. Now, okay, you got to make a living. I get that. Good for you. God bless you. Most of them are nice guys. But why do we have three or four states worth of boats all taking shrimp out of this area? It's not the way it should be. Florida needs to, when Texas and those other states are closed, Florida needs to close the food shrimpery in the Gulf of Mexico and Charlotte Harbor specifically. Right. One of the reasons, if you drive your boat from the north south in Charlotte Harbor, you notice how it's kind of flat, featureless. There's very little growth. There's very little grass. There's very little anything. And the bottom is very, very smooth and just kind of rolls a little bit. Gee, does that have anything to do with the dozens of boat dragging shrimping gear along the bottom in that very confined area?
No.
Let me think about that. If you drag a steel bar down a gravel road, does it fill in and get smoother, or does it make it rougher? Oh, I'll let you guys decide. But anyway, sorry. We have a big diversity of food here, and that's why the tarpon show up. That's why there's so much. But speaking of that big diversity... is there a key in bait? Now, I'm hearing ladyfish in the morning, threadfins or crabs all day, but I don't know what's going on at the moment.
In the pass itself you're talking about, or inside?
I don't know. Pick a spot. Any spot. You want to go to the pass. I'll see your pass and go one up. No, I don't care where you want to go.
I'm going to say, I mean, the fish in the pass kind of do get themselves on a normal pattern, and it's going to be crabs, shrimp, and squirrel fish. You know, any one of those three are going to work exceptionally well. But when they're in the harbor, you know, when they showed up early, it was really hard to dial them in. So I'm going to say that ladyfish and bait busters and storm swim baits are going to be your three primary best things to be using on them. But I did have another thought while you were talking about the tarpon moving into the harbor at first.
Are you okay with this, RJ?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm listening rapidly.
Well, you've talked about in the past about how Charlotte Harbor has its cleansing by bringing fresh water in to reduce bacteria of the salt water. And in the summertime, in the wintertime, the salt water comes back in and kills off all the freshwater bacteria and stuff like that. Do you think there might be a little bit of a correlation with some of that with the migratory tarpon coming into the harbor first as they go through the pass and come into the harbor? Do you think some of that might be a little bit of medicating themselves from traveling so much and being stressed out a little bit, that maybe getting into some of those shallower waters or up into the rivers or the mouths of the rivers might contribute to help reduce some of the parasites that they might have picked up in their long journey? Or maybe the tannin waters help reinvigorate some of their cells in their muscle tissue or something like that? Do you think any of that could have a little bit of a medicating effect?
Not at this time of year. There's no difference between the harbor and the Gulf.
Okay.
But once the rain starts, now tarpon season here in Charlotte Harbor is going to last till October.
Right.
People don't think that. They think...
no, it ends July 4th.
May and June. It's May and June and that's it. But it can start before, and it can go all the way through to the end of December. A few years ago, we had tarpon all the way to the last week of December because it didn't get cold until then.
Right.
And Boca Raton Pass was full of tarpon, and this was, 3 years ago in December, I think it was.
Yeah, 3 or 4 years ago. Not very long.
But tarpon season lasts till October. And the only difference is they spend about 2 months in Boca Grande doing the baby dance. They are literally out there primarily to spawn. So it's, you go out, you catch those tarpon, they're all, you know, the sharks move in, the tarpon move in, but it's a concentrated wad of thousands of fish, all in Boca Grande Pass. But once they leave the pass, they go along the beaches, then they come up and they scatter out through the harbor. But those fish that are here through the summer, those might like that freshwater change. Okay. Because we see tarpon go all the way up past Arcadia.
Oh, yeah.
In the Peace River.
Yeah.
There's up to Wachula. I mean, as far up as there's water in the Peace River, you'll find tarpon up there.
Sure. The same way in the Myakka River. I mean, they'll go all the way up past I-75 on the Myakka River.
Yeah, they'll go all the way up to the Myakka Lake where it starts.
Right.
Myakka State Park. So, with the tarpon, you know, going around, it's possible, but a large bunch of them leave after the Boca Grande Pass is done. Yeah. I'd say the number's reduced by about 50%.
Yeah.
Because some travel north along the beaches, some go south. They're pretty much all over the place for as far as where they're going to go. But I'd say about 50% of the tarpon stay here through October anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and their feeding pattern changes throughout that entire time where they're, you know, when they first show up, they're migrating from all over the place, from, like you said, Central America, Cuba, the Florida Straits.
Africa. They come from everywhere.
Yeah, they're feed, you know, they feed heavy on the worms, down the worm hatch down in the Keys. As they move up the southern west coast down by Marco Island, Everglades City, they feed real heavily on mullet. And then as they work their way up here, they start to feed on the crabs, the shrimp, and the pinfish, and even squirrelfish. So when they get to us, they've still got a little bit of a mindset of hodgepodge of food until the first real flush of crabs comes through that pass, and then they kind of change over to where they're really focused on that.
Well, I got a text message from a guy, and if you want to text us a question, 941-268-6460. How big of a reel do you need to fish tarpon?
Personally, I mean, it depends on if you're using braided line or monofilament. So if you're using braided line, I'm going to say just about any one of the brands out there and say a 6,000 size reel. You know, something that's capable of holding 250 yards or so of 50-pound braided line. If you're using monofilament, which we used monofilament for decades tarpon fishing and it worked perfectly fine, but you want something probably in an 8,000 size series reel because you're only going to be able to put about 30-pound mono on it, which is what we did forever. But you still want enough yardage to be able to fight those fish in case they break you off
or
dump a lot of line.
A Shimano, I got to have an 8,000 up because the Shimano reels are much smaller in a 6,000 than, say, a pen is.
Right.
The body of the reel is about the same, but the spool is a lot smaller.
Right.
So if you're doing a Shimano, I'd say at least an 8. But if you're doing a pen and you're going to use 30-pound mono, a 6,000 I think would be adequate. You know, 6, 7, 8,000. But I think a 6 would be okay with 30-pound mono.
Right.
Now, if you're going to get into 40 or 50-pound mono, you got to jump up with
significantly.
That. But for as far as 50-pound braid, a 5,000 or 6,000 reel is usually about adequate. When you're fighting tarpon, you need about 8 to 13 pounds of drag. That's where most of the fight is. Towards the end of the fight, you're probably going to bump up and maybe hit that 18 pounds of drag mark.
Right.
But that's pretty much the most normal people can hold. And I know everybody's out there going, oh, if I don't have 40, 50 pounds of drag on there, it's no good. That's marketing by reel companies. And it's the same way as just a few years ago, people wanted 16 ball bearings in a reel. The more ball bearings, the better. Now, it was a lot better for me and for Robert because we make our living selling tackle. So when you have 14, 15, 16 ball bearings in a reel or 10 or whatever it was, the reel goes bad faster.
A lot faster.
Because the ball bearings get a little bit of salt in them. And unless they're very premium, high-grade which you're not going to get that many ball bearings high grade in a reel under $200. If the reel was, you know, $100, less than $100, and you had more than three or four or five ball bearings in it, that reel is going to fall apart really nice and quickly for us. And we could sell them another reel. And those big multi-ball bearing stuff, that sold a lot of reels because they would fall apart quick. People say, I don't understand it. It's got 15 ball bearings. I paid $60 for it. Well, those were 15 of the cheapest ball bearings you could possibly buy.
Right.
And so as soon as salt got on them, bit of sand, it just chewed through the bearing, disrupted the balls and the bearing, and then just fell apart. Whereas a bushing is not as smooth, it's not as nice, but bushings last pretty much forever when you're only turning, hand cranking a reel. You know, you're not turning it at 3,000 RPMs. It's not going to get hot because you were turning metal on metal in a bushing. So right now the big thing is, if you're looking at a reel, it needs to generate about 20 pounds of drag to successfully fight tarpon. Now, having a reel like a Penn Slammer that produces 2-3 times that much is nice, because if you're a charter boat captain and you're working those reels every day, every day, every day, you're using the first third to 20% of the drag. You don't go all the way to the bottom of the drag and tighten it as much as possible. Whereas if you've got like a Shimano Saragossa or a Akuma Aero or whatever they are, Daiwa BG, these reels are going to generate 16 to 18 pounds of drag. So when you're first fighting your tarpon, you're about half, three quarters of the way into the drag. When you start locking them down to actually pull the weight of the fish at the boat, not really fighting them anymore, but just dragging that weight at you, you're locking down to get that 17, 18 pounds of pressure just to pull that 100, 150 pounds of dead weight up towards the boat. But whereas if you've got like a Penn Slammer with this mega drag stuff, and the way they do it is, instead of putting the drag washers on top of the spool, in there on the inside of the top of the spool, they put them underneath the spool. They leave one or two drag washers on the top and put the vast majority on the bottom, where they can be four times, five times the size. Problem is, if you were to lock it down, fish just rip the rod out of your hand.
Yeah.
But by utilizing just that first 20, 30% of the drag, it stays smoother much longer. You're not putting the compression on it. You're not heat building. It's a much smoother, better way to fish. Does the average person need that?
You don't have the drag barking either.
Yeah, you don't have the drag skipping and jumping. But does the average person need that, who's only out every once in a while? No, you don't need all that power.
But even the not-so-average angler, let's say, you know, okay, they complained that the drag wasn't strong enough. Now the drag's strong enough. They complained that the line wasn't strong enough. But now the biggest problem with having these really heavy drags is that something's always got to give. You're never going to win every time. So now you're seeing more lures and bait hooks getting straightened out or broken off, because a thin piece of wire can only hold so much pressure. You know?
Okay, what's the best tarpon hook on the market right now?
Right
what
now?
Size versus for what bait, and what's the best tarpon hook out there?
I guess if I had to say, as far as our number one selling hook right now for tarpon is the Trocar, the TK3 model, which is an offset circle hook in the 7-0, 8-0, 9-0.
Now, are you required to use circle hooks in tarpon?
Absolutely not. Only if you're fishing in a tournament that requires that. But as far as Florida and federal law goes on tarpon, you're not required to use circle hooks, let alone an offset circle hook. An offset circle hook's no different really than a J hook, you know, as far as hooking the fish.
Well, they can gut hook and do everything else just like any other hook.
Right.
But they're a lot easier to get out of the fish's mouth, because with that offset, you can kind of rotate a little easier.
Mm-hmm.
A true circle hook's really hard on fish because you have to rotate it out the way it rotated in.
Right.
And most fish, I don't want to stick my hand in their mouth.
Right.
With a tarpon, I can. But with the offset, it allows a little different rotation lets it get out easier.
Absolutely.
I still like J-hooks. I fish the J-hooks. I like the owner cutting point. I know 99% of the time when I'm fishing, I use VMC hooks because I think they have the best quality for the price. You can spend a little less money and get an extremely good quality hook. But that Trocar is really coming on. Nice part about it, made in America.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they're $10 a bag, too.
Yeah, they're basically a little over a buck a hook.
Yeah, but they really, they're super sharp, probably the sharpest hook ever to come into existence.
Yeah, well, and the funny part is what Trocar means, that actually comes from the medical field. That's what scalpels are sharpened to a Trocar edge. So that's where they've come up with that name. They've done basically, instead of just being chemically sharpened or machine sharpened, they're sharpening it just like a scalpel would be on a surgery table. So that not only do you get that sharp point that's penetrating through that bone of the fish's mouth, because tarpon's mouth is so bony, both the roof plate and the jawbone, they've always compared it to a cinder block. So to have a really sharp, strong point and an edge to be able to penetrate through, some of these guys are getting like full hook penetration all the way through that jaw.
Okay. Right now, Robert's not big on whitebait because I'll let him explain some of those reasons. But right now, we tell people if you're going to be consistent catching, you have to be very inconsistent on the way you fish.
Correct.
You cannot do the same thing all year. You're going to have a few good days, you're going to have a lot of bad days and some mediocre days. But the more inconsistently you fish, use shrimp when the fish are hitting shrimp, use crabs, use dead bait. Right now, I'm going to go with white baits, probably the best bait for the most numbers of fish. Now, Robert, you've got kind of a thing about whitebait. You, or maybe it's how people use it. What is it?
It's more how people use it. You know, because I agree that whitebait, you're matching the hatch. It does catch you a lot of fish this time of year. But a lot of people are under the misconception that they have to have whitebait to catch a ton of fish, which is true to an extent, but...
At this time of year. Problem is if you don't change your bait throughout the time of year, use crabs when they're hitting crabs, use pinfish, use whitebait, use shrimp, the more you change to what the fish want and the less of what you want,
right,
the more fish you're going to catch. But right now, one of the big problems is people go out and throw whitebait and expect to catch 50 fish on a trip.
Right.
And they go, well, I went there and I chummed this spot all up and there were... going through and nothing. There's no fish here. Well, did someone else just do that there
right.
the hour before you got there?
Yeah, and that's kind of where I have the problem with it. It's an instant gratification, but they don't stop and pay attention to what was different. Did they pull up to that bush and look and see, were there fish there to begin with? Because fish move a lot this time of year. Water temperatures, rain, all that stuff plays a role in it. But did they see a bottom littered with a bunch of dead bait on the bottom? Was the tide going completely different than the time before? They don't pay attention to that. So it's like I equate it to a guy who goes hunting and shoots his gun or shoots a deer at 700 yards and claims that he's a great hunter. He's not a great hunter. He's a good marksman, but he's not a good hunter. So to go out there and throw 500 white bait along a small stretch of shoreline and then bulldoze to the next spot and do it all over again and not pay attention to why those fish didn't cooperate, that's what makes you a better fisherman, is being observant to all the stuff around you. So that's why I have a problem with chumming over
right.
and over again.
So what he's referring to, if you're listening up north or, you know, and... By the way, thank you, everybody, for listening to the program. We really appreciate it. And people from all over the country and Canada and Europe and everywhere else, and we thank you very much for your interest in it. But whitebait is a hard-scale sardine, different than a soft-scale sardine. Both can be used for this, but it's a schooling bait fish, and what the people do is they throw a cast net, use sabiki rigs, but mostly with a cast net. And they'll put 100, 300, 400 of them in a live well. Then they go fishing. And when they get to the spot they're fishing, they take them out and they put them in like a bat or even throw them by the handfuls. And you scatter them out in an area where there's typically not that bait fish there. And what happens is it gets the fish in that area all excited. All of a sudden, all this bait is raining down on their head because you're throwing it up in the air, splashing the water. And these bait fish, the reason this works better is to escape a predator, they run to the surface to try and jump away or dart away close to the surface. Where if you did the same thing with a pinfish, pinfish are going to go to the bottom and wrap themselves around a rock, hide underneath the weed. They're hiders. They don't escape predators by running. They escape predators by hiding. So no matter how many pinfish you throw out there, as soon as they hit the water, first thing they're doing is going to the bottom to hide. Whereas a white bait of one form or another, greenbacks, thread fins, whatever have you, they want to go to the surface to escape, so they stay in view of the predator. They're right there. The water's very shallow. We're talking 2 to 3 feet of water. So they're running around the surface, making this fish go, wow, I didn't know I was hungry, but boy, that looks pretty good, and just makes them nuts seeing all this fish going around. And people would squeeze them to disrupt their vertebrae, squeeze the air out of their swim bladders, to disrupt them and disorient them and make them swim in circles. Well, the problem with that is, doing that when we had millions upon millions of pieces of bait in Charlotte Harbor was no big deal. But now, there's very little bait compared to the amount of fishermen. So if you disrupt, squeeze, distort, hurt those bait fish, you're in effect killing them. So every 2 you kill is 500 that's not there the next year. So tossing them out unhurt, unscathed, just the act of whipping them up in the air, letting them hit the water, when they splash down, I tell you, you belly flop from 20 feet up and see how you feel. You're going to be a little discombobulated anyway. And the fish will survive that. They'll get in there. They'll actually talk to each other. You can hear them squeaking. And they'll get together in a school, and then they'll whatever survives takes off and lives to make more babies. That's the proper way to do it. But it's the act of throwing all these bait fish up against the shoreline to see if any predators are there. Right. Anything wants to eat them. And if all of a sudden you hear them blowing up on that, and the blow up means the fish came right to the surface and literally chased that bait fish out of the water so you can see and hear the splash of the predator hitting it, snook, redfish, trout, mangrove snappers, they all do this. So watching them all boil up on it, get all crazy, it's really exciting and it's very cool to do.
Absolutely.
But put a little common sense with it. If you go into a spot and you're throwing a bunch of bait fish out, do you really want to do that, get the fish kind of full where they don't want to eat? And then you have ones out there with a hook and line, and they're not hitting them. So in today's world, if you're going to do this effectively with the white bait, we use about a 3-aught hook. We go sideways to hook them up across the nose, just like you're putting a nose ring in. Right underneath the bridge of the nose is some fairly hard cartilage tissue that won't hurt the fish. You put the point of your hook in and go sideways across the nose of the fish. Cast that bait fish up against the shore with no bobber, sinker, or anything, and allow just that bait fish to swim around very close to the trees. Give the fish a chance to hit the ones that actually have hook, line, and leader attached to them before you give them the freebies, because the one on the hook and line does not act like the one that is not attached to anything. And the fish pretty soon get to know that this one's doing something goofy and I'm going to be dragged up to the boat. All right? So throw them out with a hook in them. See if you get something neat. If you don't, just try a few pieces of bait. 2, 3, a half a dozen. Don't just do handfuls. Because the more handfuls you put out, the more the fish are being fed, the less they're actually going to want to eat the ones on the hook.
Right.
So, and if you go in an area, look on the bottom first. See if somebody else was throwing a bunch of bait there. You can literally see dead bait fish on the bottom if somebody's been there recently before you.
Yeah, it looks like change in a water fountain. Just a bunch of little silver specks all over the bottom.
Yeah, I've never been much on chumming with whitebait.
It's very fun, but it's very wasteful. It's very destructive to the environment.
Right, and I never really understood the point of it. Like you said, you throw all this bait in the water, and you know why would me, Mr. Snook, want to eat the one that's being weird when I can chase these guys? And also, that attracts the snook, I mean, to these pods of fish that are behaving like bait fish.
And the one thing about it is, when you throw a bunch of bait fish up against the shoreline, you're chumming with these live bait fish. Let's say we got a couple of guys. I have one person throwing the bait up by the mangroves and hoping for a hit. The other person is standing there, finger on the line, ready to cast. As soon as a fish blows up, you hear this big pop and you see the splash, you immediately cast right onto that splash. And that will almost always get you a hit. But if you're already out in the water, you don't have time to reel up and throw onto that splash. That fish is gone. But if you're standing there at the ready with your bait fish right there under the surface of the water, and all you have to do is pick the rod up and cast, and if you can hit that splash mark, chances are you will hook up on a fish. And the problem is most people won't wait for that. So whoever is with me or whatever, I let them cast out and get out where they want to go, and they're chumming and doing whatever, but I hold mine back. I don't want to cast until I actually have a target. So I'm target hunting with that.
Right.
Now, sharks. Lots of sharks.
Oh, yeah.
That's
super changed in the last couple days. There's still a lot of those little guys around, which is awesome. You know, the black nose, sharp nose, and even bonnet heads have started to pick back up again because there's a little lull for a little bit there on the bonnet heads. But the deep holes in the harbor, the 20-foot middle hole, pirate harbor hole, all those have got some sharks in them. But it seems like from the pirate harbor hole out through Cape Hayes is where you're starting to pick up a little bit better ones. But your larger sharks have really moved in now. They've been out at the shrimp boats just off the beaches, but with these tarpon moving into the pass, that's kind of changed the dynamics. Plus, this is the peak month for large sharks to come inshore to give birth to all of their babies. So they're coming in to feed on the tarpon. They're here to feed on the other bait fish, the Spanish mackerel, what have you, and to give birth to their young. So we've had a lot of larger bull sharks being seen from Cape Hayes out through the passes and just offshore. Even a few have been even seen in the middle holes because those big sharks will feed on the little sharks. They'll feed on those Atlantic sharp nose and black nose sharks at the same time. You know, it's pretty cool dynamic, but I've also seen some hammerheads and lemons being caught lately from beach fishermen and boat fishermen both.
Well, I tell you, so many of the people have been out tarpon fishing down around Two Pines to the north end of Okilia. And the number one bycatch, the coolest thing that's going on, is they're hooking hammerheads.
Yeah.
Scalloped hammerheads or great hammerheads or I don't know which
both.
Ones they are. Both.
I've seen a couple pictures of both.
But 6 to 10 foot long, 12 yeah. foot long.
Yeah.
They're in the harbor. Now, you're like the shark guru whisperer guy. Why don't they come north of Cape Hayes?
They do. You just don't see them as much. Because they're out in a little bit deeper water down there, you've got such cleaner, clearer water that people notice them a little bit easier than they do up in this darker water, out in that open water.
I can probably think of maybe less than I could count on the fingers of one hand caught north of Cape Hayes. I can think of dozens upon dozens. If you drew a line from Cape Hayes to Burnt Store Marina and then down to Boquilla, Two Pines, in that from Boca Grande Pass in, that little area
right.
there. I can think of hundreds or thousands that were caught there. But north of Cape Hayes, maybe half a dozen tops as long as I've been here.
I'll agree with you on that. I mean, I don't think the nut sheer numbers come up inside the way they do.
I don't think any do. I mean, outside of maybe one that, you know, got hit in the head by a boat.
Right. No, I mean, I know that some of those bigger sharks do come up into those holes because I've seen some larger sharks. I would
I'm
say
not
that
saying larger sharks. I'm talking about hammerhead specifically.
The hammerheads,
I'm not talking
honestly,
about bull sharks or lemons or whatever. I'm just talking about hammerheads.
I would have to agree with you then, because only about a half a dozen times total in the years I've been there that I've heard of large hammerheads up farther into the harbor, like into the holes.
And I mean, in 30 years.
What's the salinity?
Same.
It's all going to be the same.
Pretty close to the same.
I know that hammerheads are sensitive to salinity.
Yeah. I don't.
They're just sensitive animals in general.
Yeah.
They're very shy until they get mad or hungry.
Yeah. I honestly don't know the answer to that one other than.
The water depth isn't that different.
No, not really.
The only thing I could think of is maybe when they come in through Boca Grande Pass, they're kind of meandering in and, all right, I'm going to check this out. But they don't like being confined.
No.
They don't want to be confined into an area. And I'm just wondering if maybe there's a slight depth change right there. I'm going to have to look on the charts and see. Because a foot of water, 2 foot of water would make all the difference in the world for a hammerhead.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think when they go over, people see them in 4, 5, 6 feet of water up against the sandbar, but I think they've come in, hit that bar, and are looking for a way to get away from it. Or in the evenings, they'll go up in the very shallows to feed at night.
Right.
They'll go into 3, 4 feet of water and feed at night.
Yeah, because stingrays are one of their primary food sources, so that would make sense. And I think maybe that has something to do with maybe the huge stingray population that is down there in all those nice deep water but shallow water access grass flats. Maybe that's part of it.
I'll go along with, because I used to make a lot of money, you know, taking people out to catch big stingrays, 4 or 5 footers.
Right.
Because they're a blast on a, you know, big heavy stand-up stick, and you just let people pull until they get so tired they can't stand up. And they'd have two of them on a rod trying to drag them in. You know, I'd put 130-pound mono on there and say, "Good, pull all you want." You know, they had one guy lifting on the rod and the other guy reeling, and, you know. But that was all done off north end of Boquilla. Maybe that's why.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'll go with that.
Hey, we talk about it long enough, we can start to come up with different theories.
Yeah.
I like it.
One of the things I just want to touch on for just a second. Leader, the more invisible your leader, the more hits you're going to get. That doesn't mean that's more fish in the boat, but it means more fish on the end of the line. Now, you can do that by reducing the size of your leader. Instead of using a 60-pound, use a 20, 30, 40-pound leader. It's smaller, it's going to be less visible. And it kind of goes in ranking. The most invisible would be fluorocarbon, then monofilament, then single-strand leader, the knotable steel leader, the stuff you can tie your own knots in, and then cable leader, steel leaders.
Right.
Now, can you catch snook, redfish, tarpon on steel leader? Abso-frickin-lutely. People have done it for 100 years. Yes, you can use steel leaders. Why then do people recommend mono leader or fluorocarbon leader? Where would be the offset? If you can catch them on steel, why not just use steel?
Because would you want to catch just one or two fish that particular day, or possibly 10 or 15 fish? You know, the pressure, like you talked about earlier, we've got so much pressure with fishermen out there. Having that every little bit of advantage to your benefit is going to help. And this time of year, the water is at its clearest. So the fish can see a lot better than they will be in another month and a half. So that's where I would be going with the fluorocarbon first, then the monofilament second. You know, just to
55.
Give you the benefit of trying to catch them, and if you're fishing at night, it won't make any difference.
So basically, it's about the number of hits.
Correct.
How many fish you can get on the end of the line.
Right.
Now, why wouldn't you always use a little tiny leader? Because you'd get more fish on the end of the line.
Because they'll chew through it easier?
Yeah, you won't
It's the biteability of the leader that you need to be looking at.
Yeah.
So
That's why you've got the leader, so that they can't bite through it, or it takes them longer to bite through it or saw through it with their scales or whatever.
One of the big mistakes people think, and we don't use the word anymore, and it's kind of gone from our vocabulary, but a lot of people call it a shock leader, and they get the misinterpretation that it acts like a shock absorber, where it's stretching and bending. If you've only got 3 or 4 feet of leader, there's not that much stretch in it. I don't care what it is, unless it's a rubber band. So it's the shock of the attack. It's the wearing, the shaking, the biting, the chewing. That's the shock they're talking about.
Right.
So, but for most, say, if I'm fishing tarpon, I like to use 60-pound leader. The reason being is I can actually land the fish, get the hook out of the fish's mouth.
Right. I'll agree with you on that.
Now, when I'm doing snook, redfish, just general fishing, I usually start with 25.
See, and I'm more 30.
And I'm usually using 25, and if I get into a little bit, I hook a bigger fish, I'm going to switch up to 40. I got 25 and 40 with me on the boat almost all the time. Mm-hmm. Now, during tarpon season, I bring 60. Because now a 60-pound leader, whether it's fluorocarbon or mono, 60 for tarpon, 40 for bigger snook, bigger redfish, and 25 for just my general fishing.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. You know, the only thing that I would probably do is I would maybe also probably have some 80-pound in there just in case. Just because, like, right now there's a lot of really large tarpon around. And I might end up using like a small piece of 80 at the end of my 60 for right there around their mouth.
So you're going from your hook, say a 7-aught, 8-aught hook, going up about 2 feet and tying, or a foot and a half, 2 foot?
Yeah, about a foot or so, yeah, two
okay,
feet.
So you want at least a foot of the 80, and then you're going 60-pound up to your line.
Correct.
Another 4 foot.
Yep.
Okay.
Now, just for that added chafe, because there are so many large fish around.
Just about time to wear through it.
Yeah.
All right. So a lot of tarpon around right now. There is some bait fish in the harbor. Look around markers. Any marker. Doesn't have to be a four-poster. Doesn't have to be a specific one. Any marker on the lee side where it's eddying could hold bait fish. Look for schools going through the middle of the harbor, down around Jug Creek. And we got tarpon, we got snook, we got Spanish mackerel. There's all kinds of fish out there. Go out, have some fun fishing. Right now, we've got some intermittent days, a little bit of bad weather, a little bit of good weather. But when it's bad weather, try bass fishing. If you really okay, just take your car, go on Fishing Frank's website. Ton of freshwater spots listed on there you can drive to and fish. Shiners are your best bet. Fish and Frank here. Robert over there. RJ in the other spot. Bye. I'm going fish, 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 fish.